start.
I think we're competing with the naturalist hike, which I would like to be on. not that I don't want to be here with all of you. I start that way because I think many of you have noticed I've been a little bit hobbled, moving a little slowly around the village because I strained my ankle severely about 7 weeks ago. I tore some tendons in the ankle, and so I couldn't even bring my hiking boots up here, let alone imagine getting myself to the places in the mountains that I like to try to get when I'm here. But I think that that experience puts me in good stead to talk about our topic for today. In celebrating diversity, we know that one of the sort of categories or players in the diverse world are categories of differently abled people. We live in a world that is usually structured for people who are able-bodied in every way. And if you find yourself in a situation where you don't have the use of your eyes or the use of your ears or some limbs that are no longer with you or never were with you, you can find yourself in many, many, many circumstances every day of your life struggling in certain kinds of ways that other people don't have to and other people don't really think about or notice. So, I don't know, I've been noticing what I have been noticing because of not being able to go hiking, and I've been paying attention to some different kinds of things about these mountains that we live in. I've been looking at their silhouette a lot more often, and you know, often I like to be on a trail and within trees, and you don't necessarily see the peaks till you get to, you know, some pass, and then you get some giant expanse, and it tends to be those expanses I like to try to get to. But I guess I've been thinking more in the last few days about the nature of the bowl that this village finds itself in. I understand the surveyors who made their way up the valley long ago trying to find the passage for the railroad ended up finding the copper scar, deciding it's a good place to build a mine. And then in trying to figure out where to put a village, you know, you have to figure out where the avalanches go and where they do not go. Right? If you've ever been up here in the winter, you know that the avalanches are going pretty much all the time. You can see them often, you can hear them all the time. And yet, miraculously, the village sits right here in this spot that has been carefully evaluated as a safe spot. And so somehow my mind has just been thinking about the physical location of the village and the way in which there's an old mountain range to the north of us that's kind of flat along the top and rocky, and if you've been up there it's more slippery, and there's this much younger range of mountains here with the teeth. And I don't know, it's a way of thinking about the space. It's really different than how I usually do when I come here. So this is in keeping with our topic for the day. For those of you who've been in my other classes, we've been talking about some categories, some social categories, where many of us here find ourselves in privileged categories, and we know that there are all kinds of people in other social positions, places in the social fabric. The poor, for example, the marked subjects, not just Americans, but the Asian Americans and the African Americans and these kinds of things. One has also to be privileged in a certain kind of bodily way to get to the village and even to be here. And then our abilities vary in terms of how far we can get up or down a path, or whether we need to ask for some accommodations to live closer to the ground level of the dining hall, depending on how we move around. But again, we're aware that there are probably a lot of people who don't have really the physical ability to get here at all and to experience all the different things that the village offers. as I said on the very first day, it's not really my goal to, you know, be talking about diversity in a sort of, oh, we're all different and that's okay, and yay, you know. But isn't it neat that we share a lot of different attributes? Another error, I think, of talking about groups in underprivileged categories is to talk about them with a certain kind of pathos or a certain kind of sorrow, or isn't it too bad that there are people who have a little less than we do? It's such a shame that some people can't get here, that they can't do this, that they can't do that. And it's so easy to go down that road, and it seems like such a foolish one from certain perspectives. I'm thinking now of the biological perspective of the human being as a creature that acclimates to any environment you put it in with whatever tools it's got. The human creature has survived as long as it has because it has a fascinating ability to acclimate. I know that I'm a runner. I have been a distance runner for quite a while, and I grew up with a father who was a runner, and he had run some marathons, and he had a couple pictures of his finish line cheer at the Boston Marathon that I always admired when I was a kid, and I thought one day I'm going to try to run a marathon. And, you know, it's not as easy as it looks. I just have to say. But what was really fascinating to me, since I'm a scholar, when I started thinking about training for a marathon, I went to books, right? I talked to my dad, and then I went to books. And so I was reading about how to train for a marathon and how to plan your gradual increase of miles over the course of weeks. And all of these books would say that you really could start from scratch, from not really having been a runner, to being able to run a marathon in a span of perhaps 6 months if you do the planning right. And you just start asking yourself to do a little bit more, and if you follow a map of miles and rest days, and certain days you stretch yourself, there's one day a week that you go for your long run, and then you go on a much milder, slower run to recover afterward. These books would say, you know, there's no magic body type to run a marathon. You just need to go through the motions. That seems silly, doesn't it? You think, no, you have to have the body type of perhaps a Kenyan person. Whatever type that is, to be able to run well. Don't we all have an image in our mind of marathon finishers? And they are quite slender. And and maybe even short or small, you just kind of think you can't have much body mass somehow to run these things. And I don't even feel like I quite have a marathon body. I don't quite have my dad's skinniness, but I know I'm kind of skinny and I run shorter distances. So I slog my way through these 6 months of training for the marathon. It was grueling. It was really, really hard. And every long run, I was just dying the last 2 miles, just thinking, what am I doing? How can I do this? And then the next week, I'd have to go 2 miles further than the last time, which would be terrifying. But then it was always the last 2 miles that would be awful. So I would realize, oh, but I made it 12 miles before it really sucked this time. And then the next time, I would go 14 before I really just wanted to slay myself for having made this plan. But the first marathon I ran in 1995, I finished. I did not finish in any particularly proud time to announce to anyone. I was not last. And I wasn't even 10th from last. I don't know, it was pretty far. I don't know quite what the number of finishers were, but I was way down. And I was so stunned the whole time because people of every body, shape, and size were passing me the entire time. It was really amazing. You know, these really large guys who had shoes. shoes that were, you know, five times as long as mine, and you could hear them coming for like a mile, you know, because there's kind of a flat you know, I'd be thinking, I'm just like pitter-pattering along, but pretty slowly. And then finally makes his way by, you know.
Sasquatch.
I was passed by the Sasquatch. I was passed by the running backwards guy. Where about backwards? And I was passed by the 8 months pregnant gal. Distance runners by, I think by job even, like it wasn't just a fad, but they were really good at it, but she was 8 months pregnant, and she had a special baby sling that had been created for her, and she was just passed me, less than halfway through, pregnant lady passed me, and not just pregnant lady, 8 months.
Well, was it her first child?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. All I remember was just being like, mile after mile, wow. And I kept thinking, all of these people have just put in the time. All of these people have, for whatever reasons of their own, said, I'm going to follow this map. I'm going to ask my body to do this, and day by day by day, I keep asking it to do a little bit more, and lo and behold, here's this thing you can do that you never would have imagined that you could do. I think an analogy that people sometimes use in a negative way, in what context is this? You know the story about the frog in the hot water? Like, if there's boiling water and you toss a frog in, who would do this? How do we know these things? It's just obscene. Science is bizarre to me. But we actually know, somehow, that if you throw a frog in boiling water, it will jump back out. Okay. We also know that if you put a frog into room temperature water that it can live in, it will sit there. And if you turn a Bunsen burner on under said frog... Again, who does this? Who thinks to themselves, let's find out what frogs do when we boil them under various circumstances? But if you turn a Bunsen burner on under cold water, room temperature water, with a frog in it, the frog will not jump out. It will die there. It will boil to death. And when it reaches the boiling point, it doesn't jump out. There's something about it staying there because the incremental grades of heat as you heat it up are something that it gets used to. It doesn't register in its frogginess, this is dangerous, until it's too late. And then it no longer, you know, it passes out or something. I don't know. I didn't want to read the gory details of what exactly happens to the frog that ends up dead. But this is an interesting lesson to us, you know, that... You know, you can think of a million interesting ways in which that lesson of frog could apply in everyday life. And I think that what I like about understanding the power of the human being to acclimate has to do with what we can imagine that we can do that we think we can't. And I think that's a much more useful approach to think about varying physical abilities or what people sometimes call disabilities, rather than focusing on what people can't do. You know, cry me a river, I can't climb up to Copper Basin this summer. It's much more advantageous and positive and edifying, I think, to focus on what is the result of one thing being limited that you end up attending to or being able to do instead. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the things that those of us who can claim a certain amount of able-bodiedness somehow don't get until something takes out a part of you. And then you realize, you know, I can fight this and be angry or a victim to what I can't do, or I just, and or, maybe both and, I figure out the kinds of things that I can do. And your body will figure out what its capacities are. I know that an acquaintance of mine who's in a wheelchair knows what size of door he can or can't get through, but doesn't have to test it, doesn't have to worry, you know. And I know I might think, you know, as they're heading for a door, uh-oh, you know, look out, have you checked? Did you measure, like, wheel to wheel? Or, you know, I don't know what I'm thinking, because I'm just an idiot, able-bodied person. But, you know, people who are used to themselves in their set of abilities can do amazing things. They get used to themselves. This is the package that I'm in. Just like the ones that we are in that cause us not to have to think about certain things. I guess I thought that I would invite you. I didn't necessarily tell you to bring pen and pencil. I see that several of you did. That's fine. It's not quite as much a writing class as a thinking, and I have a little bit longer excerpt to read to you. I thought it might be good to think for a few moments to ourselves or jot down notes. If you can think of a moment when you have been with somebody very differently abled than you in some way that has stood out in your memory. You know, I think that's a difference that we often notice, often startling. It's a kind of difference that small children who don't know any better will often blurt out about. But go back in your memory banks and see if you can remember a moment where you were in a situation with or observing or interacting with somebody with very different abilities of yours, and see if you can reflect on what you maybe were thinking at the time, and maybe especially what resides in the memory is what we're feeling at the time. Don't have to write it down, but I'll ask for a few volunteers in a few moments. Kind of assume we all have these moments. Maybe some of you don't have them coming to mind swiftly. I'll share mine because I feel embarrassed by it, and maybe that will open us all up to being willing to share embarrassments and awkwardnesses. I think this is a difference in our culture that often creates a lot more awkwardness instantly than finding yourself in a neighborhood with people who are of a different ethnic background than your own or something. You know, there might be ways to bump into one another and be an idiot in those contexts, but it's not quite there's something visceral about someone whose body is different. Probably there are scientists who have done some studies about why we're wired this way. But in the town I grew up in, there was a guy who was in a wheelchair and he had some kind of lifelong palsy. I'm not sure what. He had really shaky hands. He was in a wheelchair. He didn't have much in the way of legs. It was kind of a small presence on a wheelchair. He pulled around. And the muscle, I'm no medic, I know virtually nothing, but he had a kind of muscle damage that caused his face to be fairly slack and didn't have much muscle control. And he could speak, but it was often very difficult to hear what he was saying. And his family and people on his block who knew him well could usually, you know, like with little kids, you know, when they're making stuff up, you know, you figure out what, when you're there often, you find out what they're saying, but it's difficult to tell. And I found myself in a deli in town or a cafe or something with this guy, and we were both in line and we were trying to order sandwiches. And I thought I was going to be helpful. You know, he was like lower than the counter, and I was going to ask him what he wanted. And I ended up talking to him as though he was a four-year-old. Just in, I slowed down my voice and I was talking kind of in a goofy, like, can I help you, you know, order a sandwich? What kind of sandwich do you want? And this guy is talking to me and, you know, I'm trying to figure out what he's saying or whatever. He's been in the sandwich shop a million times, right? This is his hometown too. And I'm just the young dork who happens to have found myself encountering him in this moment, you know? And, you know, the guy at the counter knew him and kind of gets him his regular, and they sort of share a joke or whatever and go out the door. And I was just horrified at myself inside that it took me a while to figure out exactly how inappropriate that was. And I had a moment when I got home where I was just thinking, oh my God, if I was inside that body and had people doing this to me all day long, I would just be rageful. I would just, you know, want to poke everyone's eyes out all day long. Like, don't talk to me like I'm four, because my ability to move my mouth is different than yours. So that's one that really stings and stays with me, that I think about a lot. I wonder if anyone has anything to share that just sort of helps make visible to us these moments of encounter where we don't always make the best decisions.
I had an experience a number of years ago. I was running a management consulting firm. A professor at the University of Wisconsin by the name of Jim Grassman, he was running the graduate school of real estate up there, and he needed someone to help out in the specialty that was my specialty. And so I was in Milwaukee, and I got a phone call from his secretary that they wanted to see me. So I said, fine, and we arranged the meeting and so forth. So I drove up there, and his office was in his home, and so I went to his home, and I walked up the stairs and knocked on the door, and this woman answered, and I walked in, and here he's in this tall chair, and he's a quadriplegic. Mm-hmm. He's dressed in a white shirt with a bow tie, and he's just dressed to kill, and he has to use his mouth to operate any mechanisms that he does because he can't, he's a quadriplegic. And I was really taken aback. And I just put my hand on his shoulder and I said, Mr. Graskamp, it's a pleasure meeting you. Let's get busy. And so we got to work. And but it was a real shock, a very unexpected encounter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and you recovered from your shock in a timely fashion, and it sounds like you did fairly well. Would that I had helped with the sandwich in a normal way. But yeah, we come up against this moment in ourselves of recoil, I think, sometimes. And how we get ourselves to be the kind of person who can interact with our own response smoothly enough to then move forward interacting with the human being in front of us that is there is sometimes hard to do. And I think sometimes we get afraid enough of our response that we don't want to go near people who look different, because then we're like afraid of screwing up. And you know, I think there are all kinds of ways of doing badly what could be fairly normal situations if we were just a little more self-conscious of humanity in a variety of shapes and abilities, as well as colors, as well as these other kinds of things. Anyone else? Yeah.
Just looking a little differently at it, I've stood back a little and decided with some kids to talk to them more like they're adults, just instead of talking like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I really felt like it made a nice difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially if I heard somebody else talk to them, you know, and they're kind of not responding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it made me think about it, similar type.
Yeah.
Positive outcome.
Yeah. I'm guessing guessing that all of us also have some spot in our memory banks where someone has looked at us with some shock and behaved awkwardly. And that can be for any number of reasons. You know, you're dressed in a way they're not expecting you to be dressed, or, you know, I don't know what. But we know what it feels like to be treated with a tone of shock and surprise and unnatural awkwardness. And so I think if we can, you know, be able to bring to mind how much we don't want to feel like that, it can help us remind ourselves how to behave, how to care for others as we would like to be cared for. Anyone else with a story that you wish to share? My main goal was to get you to get into that set of feelings, so we don't need all of the stories, but I saw two hands at once. Yes, please.
During the last phase of my mom's chemotherapy treatment for breast cancer, she ended up partially losing her ability to taste. Mm-hmm. And this ended up thankfully being a temporary thing, but this happened right around Christmas. And for my folks and me, having food around Christmas and having very good food is second in importance only to spending lots of time at church. And so what we ended up with is my dad and I, since it was clear that she could taste some things but not others in certain qualities, the question became what qualities were normal and what wasn't, and how to work with this. And so over the course of about a week or so, we were sort of trying little bits of various food with her, and of course she herself wasn't quite sure how she was going to respond, and sort of basically poking at things until we figured, okay, these sorts of things are going to work and these sorts of things aren't, and then using that. And I don't remember what all we came up with for Christmas dinner that year, but most of what we ended up eating actually worked out for everybody. But there was a lot of work involved, and it was also a big sense of care and satisfaction for all involved that it worked as well as it did.
Yeah, that's a great outcome too. Yeah. Do you want to share as well?
I was going to, I had a cousin, first cousin, who had severe cerebral palsy, so he had no ability to walk or couldn't control his movements, couldn't speak. And so his parents, my aunt and uncle, care of him, but he was often with us, for family events and Christmas and so on and so forth. We were used to Eddie. He was always in the chair. He had to be tied in his wheelchair because he couldn't sit. We sort of lived our life in parallel, but we didn't interact with him, and in retrospect, I can see, we didn't touch him, we didn't do those kinds of things, because it was hard to know how to relate to him. You couldn't talk to him. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. His mother and father, my aunt and uncle, could sort of read his mind. They mm-hmm. communicated with him very well, but it was only through sort of intuition.
Yeah.
And so the rest of the family didn't have that.
Yeah.
So then there becomes sort of a pushing away in some sense, not intentionally, but
Well, and I think in those kinds of instances, we realize that the one thing that is going to get us better able to understand or to interact in a positive and healthy way is more time together rather than less. So that instinct to sort of spend less time around the person who might be making us awkward is not necessarily the ethical choice, right? It might be an instinct, but the ones who spend the most time are going to be the people who are going to be able to interact most naturally and most healthfully. And that's a good reminder. A lot of times we don't want to put in that time or feel too uncomfortable at the beginning portions of that time. And who wants to cause to make themselves feel uncomfortable, But then when you realize what kinds of discomfort one might be in who doesn't want to be that way, you can think, oh my God, what a selfish position to take. Yeah, Scott?
It strikes me that you know, much of our conversation has to do with the kind of emotional complexity and awkwardness that these encounters create in the person who does not have the difficulty the different ableness that we're describing. So the awkwardness that it creates in us, and the emotional kind of complexity, and sometimes feelings of shame, and how I think there's a very similar, if not very similar dynamic that goes on with people who, you know, have experienced like tragic loss or something like that, and the difficulty that people have in relating to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's an analogy to kind of people who have experienced kind of emotional trauma or tragedy,
mm-hmm.
and the discomfort oftentimes it creates in people not knowing how to relate to them too. And
yeah.
It's a very similar dynamic.
Yeah.
I think. Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of ways to be broken
yeah,
in the
right.
world,
yeah.
and any one of those ways can cause us to be anxious.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of why this 1 week out of my two here, I my little title for it, such as it is diversity, thinking about the centers of groups rather than thinking about the margins, you know, rather than looking at and sort of like you're putting under a microscope, oh, those people who are different, what are their experiences like? Really wanted to draw our attention to what the experience of privilege is like, because I think that's where more of the work needs to happen. People on margins, whatever categories, they know what they have to face every day and they are busy acclimating to it. And it's those who are in the privileged place who don't have to be in a position to be interacting or whatever, who are often behind the eight ball. So that's a very useful reminder too, that, you know, it's the awkwardness of being able to do something that someone else can't that is one of our biggest challenges. You know, we just have to be better versions of ourselves somehow. At this juncture, I would like to have a couple of volunteers in the group who are willing to have a few of their senses dulled for a short span of time. I have some pairs of earplugs here and some pairs of ear, I don't know what those are called. I'm no mechanic.
Dollars.
I see two hands up already. I haven't even finished introducing the objects, and you guys are willing to be deaf.
What you going to do with that?
Okay, so I'll give you each the earplugs going first, and then these things are going to go on. And your job, once those are on, is to just be part of our group and keep paying attention to what we're doing. And we're going to call on you afterward to talk to us about what you notice and such. So that's really your only job. Sitting there and one for you, sir.
Doesn't help much yet.
What's that?
Doesn't help much yet.
That's going to have a big help, but that's just going to be the backup. You're putting in the backup version first. And then, these go. They're a little different than the rubber bar goes behind your head, the back of your head. I'd like to have a couple of people who are willing to not have eyes for a few minutes. I found a perfectly comfortable way to have you not have eyes. So. Right. And maybe you can get a colleague to help tie that around you. And then who would like to wear the child apron as an eye block?
I know, sure.
Yeah? Okay. I'm wondering if I could have somebody pretend to be me 6 weeks ago and not use your leg from the hip down for a little bit. And I will hand these to you, and we're going to be doing some stuff. Anyone willing to
be a tall person?
Oh. You want to try these out? So pick a leg. Which leg are you going to use?
Now, I've had to use them way in the past.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Familiarity is totally fine. Yeah. Just don't let me see you using that leg.
Okay.
And you know, you can sit on the other half of your end. Then let's see. Are there a couple of people who are willing to be armless for a little bit? And this is only going to require you to stick your hands in your back pockets. You going to be the armless sisters?
Yes.
Armless sisters. Ladies and gentlemen.
So you can pick one arm or two arms. My grandmother, my mother's mother, grew up on a ranch, and she got her hands caught in baling wire when she was 3 years old. She only had one thumb on one hand and one little finger on the other hand, and wow, there was nothing she couldn't do. You know, it was one of those things that if she was always self-conscious about photos being taken of her. She didn't want them to be seen in photos, but if you were loud in church, that pinch was as bad as that pinch. You know, there's nothing that wasn't able to happen there. So, all right, so we've got some people who have fewer abilities. Yeah, it's not so comfortable, is it? I guess if you want to just pretend that, you know. So we're going to do a couple of things with a couple different sets of these people. Let's see. I need two volunteers to pair with the people who do not have ears right now. Anyone who just wants to be their partners in crime for a minute. Oh, there you go. A good acting thing. All right, let's start with one volunteer who will be willing to do a little activity with one of our earless folks. This will only work if someone will. Otherwise, we'll all just sit here and stare at the people who are wearing it. Things. You want to be a volunteer?
Yeah.
Okay. So your job, I've got a bowl of peas here. And you're just going to share them. I'd like you to help them eat some peas.
But they can use their hands.
They just don't have ears.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Just not stick them in their ears.
Yeah, and maybe have them come up here, because that just makes it a little more complicated. Yeah, so the peas are here, and you're going to have to. Can you get them to sit back down?
Tell them only one.
Yep. All right. Any immediate reflections on their interaction?
It was so simple because it was so matter of fact. You know, it was not as if you made the assumption that they had any less ability other than just not being able to hear you.
Yeah, so
and for some reason, I expected you to kind of feed them or help them.
That is very interesting. Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
That's your impulse at the sandwich store.
I could see everything she was doing.
I noticed that you didn't say anything.
Yes, that's right. She didn't talk.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are hearing impaired who read lips perfectly fine, but somehow it's quick for us to not do the sensory thing that we see them not being able to do. But they did still manage to eat the peas, so that worked out all right.
And probably because I misunderstood your instruction, I was a little startled because I thought you were going to invite one person, and the other person just thought, oh, I'm invited. You know, and I looked over and two people are coming, you know. But maybe that had been the goal, but I still, that sense that happens,
mm-hmm.
that people misunderstand.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it wasn't me.
Yeah.
Or it was, you know, they don't know when they're included,
mm-hmm.
if the direction is fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask the people wearing the blindfolds? What did you notice about the interaction?
I didn't really know what was happening until you said to feed. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Were you concerned about not knowing what was happening? Is there any feeling you had as I was doing this project with some other folk? Anything?
Well, seeing shows you a lot of things, but you use your other senses then.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you want your nose uncovered so you can breathe and smell. You know, if you were given food, then you smell the food, you
mm-hmm.
know, so you
mm-hmm.
would know that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're hearing, and you would touch
mm-hmm.
to find out, or I would ask questions about it, but I can't see or know what color, or, you know, if it's, I'd have to feel
mm-hmm.
it to know if it was solid or, you know, or what was going on.
Did you guys notice that they didn't talk? You know, you heard what the instructions were, but did you notice the lack of verbal cue or not necessarily?
I wouldn't expect there to be any verbal cue if somebody can't hear.
Interesting.
I studied sign language, and
mm-hmm.
I think of, you know, a visual language.
Yeah.
So it just didn't bother me that
okay.
there wasn't any talk. But I didn't know, I knew before I had my blindfold on who had their ears covered. I didn't know who had offered to help.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
right.
really, it makes a difference for me,
oh, okay.
but I can imagine what I am missing in my sight.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I was curious, well, who got up to
yeah.
listen?
So you don't know if you're going to have to get out of the way
spoke.
Of someone?
I can't imagine your face because I didn't, you weren't, I hear it before mm-hmm. I put my blindfold on. So I was like, who is that?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know this person.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Well, yes, please.
I guess I was thinking that if I was in a group like this and helping those two, I probably would have done it similarly. If I'd known in the group that there were a couple people that couldn't see, I probably would have talked more.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So they knew what was
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that
even
was.
Though I wouldn't have
yeah.
for those people.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
I think there was a level of security in doing this exercise simply because there's a sense of group here already,
mm-hmm.
which I think helped.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been different if having a chance meeting
mm-hmm.
on the street or a
yeah.
a new relationship.
That's right. That's a good point. I wonder if I might have two volunteers who would take our blindfolded people and just walk them outside and back. Yeah, we're going to continue, but if you would just make that little track and come back.
I just know that.
Second volunteer, did you find a...
Okay, there's a chair right here. So
then I'm going to ask...
on your right.
On my right?
Yeah, there's a chair there.
Okay. What is the last thing I want to do?
No,
pick and choose among my options.
And we're just kind of
I'm wondering if you might be so kind as to feeding someone in the back row some of the peas.
Okay.
Off you go. Yeah. And I'm actually wondering if you guys might feed your parents some peas as well.
Would you like some peas?
Please, sir. I would like some more.
Please, sir.
Are they
do you how many arms do you guys have?
You
don't have any.
One of you put away two arms and now one of them's back out again. Let's go with one hand among the four arms.
Right.
Yeah. And it's your parents and your siblings, so you can figure out whatever you need to do, but yeah.
Okay.
You've got a role here, nevertheless.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Mom doesn't like. Mom doesn't like the pot, so she wants to show. Yeah, she doesn't show.
Yeah. It's like gone to the falls.
I don't think your dad.
Oh, you're letting them peel their own, huh? Oh, you got some, you got one.
Here.
Nice.
Good work.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. All right. So these are good questions. You guys can be done with the piece if you'd like. We've got some colleagues who will be on their way back sooner or later, depending on how their guidance goes. So this raises some questions for me. What could you do?
I felt like I could do not much at all.
Yeah. Anyone else with some ideas about how one could be participatory in such a task?
Talked. I didn't stop to say, well, thank you for serving, bringing the peas or offering peas.
You get all concerned about the logistics.
Yes,
I was going to spit on your peas.
I could at least have been appreciative of bringing.
Uh-huh.
And also, for bringing it for him because he did.
How many of you, just in these small range of activities, have felt a little uncomfortable about just watching them try to be undertaken? Yeah. What is that discomfort about, do you think? I'm just kind of curious about.
Feeling bad that I have the abilities that I'm seeing these others don't.
Lacking the experience of being near. I've never had to live with anyone who has a disability or be in close proximity with someone.
Yeah.
So I haven't learned how to deal with that.
Yeah. You end up going, what? Mm-hmm. You know, a simple instruction. Had some deliciousness to share, but it's suddenly big, just taking a bite of food is a big deal. There are a couple other hands. Yeah. Oh, what is it about?
Being intuitive, or, drawing on intuition rather than routine.
Mm.
Being challenged by intuition, perhaps.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I think there's a sense of being uncomfortable when someone has to use sloppy means to eat the food. Makes me, it's not clean and neat and regular.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt embarrassed for them. Mm-hmm. I didn't want them to feel like they should be embarrassed, so I felt bad for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's nothing routine. Everything has to be thought about and considered. And so it feels like it's a foreverness. What are they going to do? What are they going to not do? What are they going to
drop it?
So you're totally attuned to that because you haven't gotten into a comfort level yet of how these kinds of things work.
Yeah. Anyone starting to feel awkward about the fact that our sightless people
maybe it was out to the dock and back.
They heard the dinner bell.
They're talking. Something to be really serious about that. I don't know why.
Did we know that?
Didn't we know they were allowed to come in?
Probably the one that didn't see her name. Must be.
I know just who you're talking about.
Yeah, so we're going to go down in front of these chairs. But first segment.
Sorry,
okay. All right. And once you're seated, you can unblindfold.
Okay. Just
and
you'll be fine.
Just coming around the fence.
Oh, sorry.
You look really cute.
Here's your chair, reach down, you'll feel this is not
for us. Switch
corners. Okay.
And that's the left one.
All right. Phew. So, thank you for all partaking of all of those things. I just asked our ear free people to be ear themselves again. Tell me a little bit about your experience of the last several minutes. Feelings, thoughts, observations, anything at all? Just come back.
Well, I thought it was. I was aware that I wanted it just to be a challenge and to watch the gestures of people. I thought the lady in red back here, when Rab brought the peas over to them, that you were thankful. Maybe missed it, but it
Did anyone else notice what the recipient of said peas looked like upon receipt? Okay. Interesting. Yeah. So you're aware right away what you're going to be paying attention to get the most information that you can, and that's going to be people's facial expressions. We all know that we read facial expressions a lot, but we tend to tune into the facial expressions of the people we know and that we're used to reading. And a lot of the time with strangers or people we don't know very well, we don't necessarily, you know, they're sitting there, you know, and if they're laughing, we know they're laughing or whatever, but we don't necessarily look as closely. And there's still a lot of information to be gained from any of those cues. So that's really interesting.
Dorothy, I've known for a long time, you made 2 points.
Oh.
I don't know if that was true or not, but it worked.
I said I didn't.
Yeah. I remember saying that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. A couple of things to say. Yeah. Cool. Scott?
Well, at first I too was really trying to pay close attention to facial expressions. And I felt myself like just kind of losing concentration and interest. It was like, it just felt kind of like, it was just very, very hard to be a participant in any sense. So I nodded off at one point, it's a feeling of just isolation.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone notice that about
Scott? Ernest question,
yeah.
My dad's hearing is almost gone, and that's what he does, is he just withdraws because he stays engaged for a little bit, and then when he can't read or hear or something, he just disengages. He's very sad and just withdraws.
Yeah.
I just heard a story on public radio last week about a boy a man now who was born deaf and had cochlear implants when he was a teenager, and he was just bombarded by all this noise that he could hear them, and he chose to lose them and be deaf. He said it's better to be deaf.
I
just thought it was amazing.
He wasn't
gotten acclimated to one thing that worked.
Yeah, he couldn't
somehow
just disregard some of the noise.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I'd rather be deaf.
Mm-hmm.
I have both a brother-in-law and my niece's husband who are totally deaf. And then they have both, and they can read lips and talk and, I mean, you know, just all over the place. So the whole family can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But then they both got cochlear implants, and the young man who got it, he could respond to it better. But when he first got it, he needed to have the sound way down because everything was so loud.
Mm-hmm.
And he jumped up at night, and Kathy said, "What happened, David? What's that noise?" he said. And it was rain, and it was very soft.
Mm-hmm.
He had never heard it, and he was just, it was like, you know, something was happening to the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, because he was used to the lights and all those things he'd had.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother-in-law, it doesn't work as well for him, and the doctor said, "You're just choosing not to do it."
Mm-hmm.
And he does. He just chooses to kind of cut it off sometime. If he doesn't want to, he just doesn't hear.
Yeah.
And now Kathy and her, they have their third son, and the baby is deaf. They notice that can't hear.
they noticed when the smoke detector went off, that was the first time there was something. So now he's been examined and at 10, well, he just got hearing aids, but trying to keep hearing aids in a little 3-month-old, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now at 10 months, he can get a cochlear implant.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I wonder how that will work.
Yeah. Probably a lot better because the brain.
Yeah,
sure. Well, the brain will start.
Start working.
The brain
And the kind of normal point is to blindfold him.
Oh.
Ladies.
Disappeared. Left. Then they were gone for a while. Yeah. Did you feel any anxiety over that lack of knowledge? Or?
No, I was just wondering why they...
Yeah.
We missed the unblock part.
Yeah.
Apparently.
We were so maybe we were supposed to wait, so we waited and just talked about it.
You know, we run a little low on time, and I'm interested in this conversation. I'm interested in this observation of Scott's that he is just sort of tuning out, and interested in us asking ourselves what are the implications for ourselves if we're in the company of people who are hearing impaired. For being aware, and what might we do to be more inclusive? Or, you know, we're all thinking, oh, this is an exercise, and we've been told to do X and Y, so we're just going to let you sit over there, you know, in your little cone of silence or whatever. But, you know, if we're just trying to be community to people who are different than ourselves, we might need to go out of our way to sit closer, to talk with our hands, to... you know, there's any number of things. I don't know, you know, whether he hasn't been able to hear since he was 3 or since last year or whatever. But these are real implications to just try to be more aware about, because we all know that human beings need touch. You know, human babies who aren't touched will die, even if they have enough food and water and everything else. And that continues to be true for anyone into adulthood. So these moments where we've talked about people kind of feeling like withdrawing, or you know, you feeling like withdrawing because you can't quite access what's going on, or in your anecdote when you said it, you know, people just withdrew because you kind of don't know how to interact, and then you realize later nobody was touching this person. You know, those are really important things for all of us to be attuned to. Quick question. I want to read just a couple paragraphs of this story, this Raymond Carver story, because they're quite hilarious and moving, and will have to be enough of a sound bite that you might end up remembering the name and going to find this story. It's widely anthologized and easy to find, but I do want to squeeze that in. But the leaders of the people who couldn't see, what kind of feelings did you have about that role? Is any quick word about that?
I was fine with it.
You were fine?
Yeah.
Anything hard about it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You were very careful, though.
I was just going to say
that you would not have her, that she knew exactly what she was doing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted her to be aware of her surroundings.
That's right,
sure. Yeah.
And you talked a lot to her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was my fear, that she would trip or fall or
mm-hmm.
or have something scare her that she'd get into.
I noticed that you depended on her knowing, like, the board was here, and so you're walking in front of the board.
Mm-hmm.
I have a neighbor who, you just don't always remember where things are, and it helps to have the person have seen it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The scariest part for me, though, being blind, was when she said there's an incline, and I thought,
oh.
I've walked in here so many times, but I can't remember how long it was. I meant coming back. I thought, oh, my.
Mm-hmm.
Going down, you could fall or trip.
Mm-hmm.
That
yeah.
bothered me more, the elevation, than...
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, everything in one's life shifts and becomes kind of difficult. I have a mere torn ligament in my ankle, but it's my right foot, so I couldn't drive for 4 weeks. And so I'm feeling mainly pretty healthy, you know, and I'm still calling up friends to bring me groceries and feeling, you know, like you can hardly see what's wrong, but the very particular of where the injury was meant that a lot of stuff was different in my life all of a sudden, and it was quite startling. Shoot, this story. Let me just characterize to you this story, and I can loan it if anyone's interested, or I could put it at the end of the dining hall or something like that. It was too long to have read in full anyway, and it is certainly the kind of story that the fullness of it is really kind of necessary anyway, but... The story is in the first person, and the speaker is a guy who is fairly closed-minded, kind of bigoted, kind of a doofus. I don't know, he's just not very self-aware, not very sensitive to other people. He's married, and his wife has a longtime friend who is blind, who is coming to visit. And this guy is very awkward about this visit for a number of reasons. He's a little bit jealous of the long-standing relationship between his wife and this guy. He remembers that his wife had told him at one point that when they had first met, she and the blind gentleman, he had asked to feel her face. He was wanting to know sort of who he was with or what she looked like, and so he had felt all over her face, and she had written a poem about that experience because it was interesting to her. And so then she shares with her husband this poem about what it felt like for this blind guy to be touching her face, and he's very uncomfortable just for a lot of reasons. He's like, I didn't like the poem, I didn't really want to tell her that, but it's very awkward. And he's trying to figure this out. He's piecing together, sharing with us, the listener, the fact that he knows that the reason the wife has extended an invitation is because this gentleman's wife has just died. There's a long passage where this guy is just baffled about intimacy between a blind person and the person that he's with. He's going, can you imagine having sex with someone that can't see? I mean, how did that work? And there's also a sort of poignant moment where he's thinking, what would it feel like to never be able to see in the eyes of your beloved the love that they have for you? And he sees that as a great loss, and it causes him for a split second to feel sorry for the blind guy. But then he's back to being very uncomfortable and obnoxious about the blind guy. It's quite a hilarious story in the tone of this guy, because he's kind of an everyman, kind of figure. There's nothing to really dislike about him, except that he's just so insensitive. And his wife is like, I cannot believe, that you're asking these ridiculous questions. You know, he's out of his discomfort. He's making jokes before the guy gets there. He's saying to his wife, what am I going to do with the blind man for an evening? Maybe I can take him bowling, And she's like, would you shut up? You are such an obnoxious person right now about this whole visit. So anyway, the blind guy comes. They have an awkward dinner. They have an awkward time sitting around. They forget the year of this story, but they end up smoking some marijuana together to soothe everyone's discomfort for some reason. The wife decides to go to bed and leaves these two men sitting together in the living room. Of course, by now the guy is just like, I'm sitting in the same room with them, and I'm like, he cannot figure out how to say anything normal, how to behave normally. It's just, and the blind man is very sensitive. I mean, he's, I'm sure, had people interacting with him in this manner for a long time, so he's very patient and saying, well, actually,